Hey gang, welcome to another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio on the Republic Broadcasting Network, RBN, republicbroadcasting.org. It's the soliloquy of free speech. Why a soliloquy? I don't know. I don't even know what a soliloquy is, but that's what it is. So I think it's when you're just talking all by yourself. And that's what I'm going to do today, just talk all by myself with some crickets in the background and cicadas. Gotta have the cicadas. So go to republicbroadcasting.org, click on the donate button, send badly needed fundage. All right, well, 24 hours ago, I heard that former Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev had passed away after a prolonged illness. And, you know, for most people, well, okay, he was somebody who led a major, you know, he led a superpower in the 1980s, and maybe they don't think about him too much. I was an enormous fan, and so I need to do a show entirely about Gorbachev and his legacy. You know, I have a pair of... Well, I have a Gorbachev piggy bank, for one thing. I do. I have a Gorbachev piggy bank. And I have a pair of matching Gorby and Ryza bedroom slippers. Right? With Gorby and Ryza, they're like in their twin beds, but I can stick my feet in there and walk around. Why? Because I'm a fan. I never got to meet Mikhail Gorbachev. Dr. Duke did. Stephen F. Cohen, who passed away... Was it a year or 2 years ago? Maybe it was 2 years ago. He got to know Gorbachev quite well. I didn't know Stephen F. Cohen that well. Knew him a little bit. But Gorbachev, apparently Stephen F. Cohen's daughter would refer to Gorbachev as her godfather. So that's pretty cool. I knew a professor from Cornell University, Ned LeBeau, who had interviewed Gorbachev. He and his partner, Judith Stein, they were doing, this would have been in the 80s, maybe 1990, but probably late 80s, they had done a big project on the Cuban Missile Crisis. And they were over, apparently in the Kremlin, doing some research. They were allowed in the Kremlin and got word that President Gorbachev, or maybe at the time he was General Secretary Gorbachev, wanted to talk to them. So they go on, and Gorbachev asks them questions about their findings, you know, Cuban Missile Crisis, and they answer Gorbachev's questions. And at the end, Ned LeBeau says, "Well, what do you think? What's your idea about it?" And Gorbachev told LeBeau and Stein, he said, "Well, I think Khrushchev and Kennedy just wanted to see who had the bigger schlong." That's what he said. At least that's what Ned LeBeau said, that Gorbachev said. So, but I never met him. David Duke spent a long time in Russia, was 4 or 5 years over there, Russia and I guess Ukraine together. And he met Solzhenitsyn, he met Gorbachev, he met Gennady Zhuganov, the Communist Party leader, who was duly elected president, but was cheated out of it. He met Vladimir Zhirinovsky, the half-Jewish, hardcore anti-Semite Russian nationalist. It takes all kinds to make the world go around. So he's got all those people that he's met, and probably a bunch more. I never met anybody prominent in Russia with one exception, Svetlanoslav Fyodorov. Svetlanoslav Fyodorov. Not exactly a household name in America, but he was a world-famous eye surgeon. He invented... What was it? Did he invent the surgery, like, that became LASIK surgery? I think he invented the surgery that became the kind of surgery that corrects nearsightedness. At any rate, I did get to meet him. He ran for president in... What did he do? He ran for president of Russia... I guess it was in 1991 when Yeltsin first ran and was elected. I think that was the election, and then he died shortly after that. But this is about Gorbachev and Andrew Anglin, whom I've got a great deal of respect for. But he wrote an article and put it out there in the Daily Stormer for Wednesday morning, saying, I think the headline was, "The American Biden sends his condolences to the family of the Russian Biden," referring to Gorbachev. Well, I'm sorry. I mean, I know that Gorbachev, when Gorbachev ran for president of Russia in 1996, actually, I guess it was 1996 that would have been 96? It would have been 96. In 1996, Gorbachev ran, and so did Fyodorov. That was the year. Fyodorov might have run in 91, too. I'm not sure. But he ran in 96. Gorbachev ran in 96. Fyodorov had like 0.8%. Gorbachev had 0.5%. A massive humiliation. And so Gorbachev is not just not popular in Russia. I think he's rather reviled in Russia. And he's blamed for destroying the Soviet Union. And Andrew Anglin's article reflected that widespread Russian view. I talked about this on David Duke's show earlier today. Excuse me. I have a touch of the deadly coronavirus, so I had to pop a lozenge in my mouth. At any rate, President Gorbachev. So, he's not popular in Russia. I disagree, though. The idea that he's responsible for destroying the Soviet Union, which many Russians and many non-Russians view as actually having been the destruction of the Soviet Union, the dismemberment, the breakup. Excuse me. I'm not used to sucking on lozenges. Anyway, the breakup of the Soviet Union was a geopolitical disaster. Why? Well, you went from a bipolar world where you had a balance of power to a unipolar world where you had what Professor Daniel Dudney, I think that's his name, from the University of Pennsylvania, described as bandwagoning, where everybody was jumping on the American bandwagon and the United States could do whatever it wanted. And what did the United States want to do? Well, it wanted to do wars for Jews. That's one thing. And, you know, eventually, well, and it wanted to do free trade, certainly been promoting gayness and now trannyism. Refugees, anyone? Anyone for refugees? So the unipolar world's been a disaster, and the unipolar world was made possible by the breakup of the Soviet Union. So I do think it's fair to look at the breakup of the Soviet Union as a disaster, and I felt that way at the time. Now, then you have to assess, well, why did it break up? And, you know, Gorbachev has stated, when he became general secretary in 1985, March 1985, upon the death of Konstantin Chernenko, he became general secretary, and general secretary was the position of the leader of the Soviet Union. They had an office that would commonly be referred to as president, but it was really the chairman of the presidium of the Central Committee or the Supreme Soviet or something like that. It was not an executive presidency. And you had people like, something Podgorny. I even forgot his first name. I want to say Yevgeny Podgorny. I don't remember. Podgorny had been president for a long time. Brezhnev took that post for a little while, as I recall. And for a while, when Gorbachev, at least for the first 3 years of the Gorbachev era, it was Andrei Gromyko, who had been the longtime foreign minister. it was kind of an honorary position that he retired to. The top dog was the chairman of the Soviet, the general secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, the CPSU. So when he became chairman of the CPSU, or general secretary, he, looking back, said, well, he could have just continued without major reforms. And he was, you know, he was at the time, what would he have been, 50, he was in his early 50s, maybe, I think he was born in 31, right? So that would mean in 1985, he would have been 53, 54. He was young, and could he have ridden it out another 20 years? I don't know. Maybe. He said that he thought, like at the time he could have, just ridden out, like, you know, been a typical Soviet leader, tried to keep a lid on things. But he asked himself, if not me, who? If not now, when? And the thing is, the Soviet Union, I'd been to the Soviet Union before Gorbachev. And it was very bureaucratic. It was heavy-handed. It was repressive. I was a tourist, but as a tourist, if you wanted to go somewhere, you had to go through all these processes. You had to get your vouchers for in tourists, to get the train tickets, to get the hotels. Everything had to be done long in advance, and we're using a telex machine to, you'd go down to the in tourist office, use a telex machine, come back 2 weeks later, maybe they'd have some news for you, maybe they wouldn't. That was my experience as a tourist. But if you went into a restaurant, you sit down, nobody would, the waiters wouldn't come over. They'd come over eventually, but you might just be sitting there for a long time. Nobody really seemed to care. They couldn't be bothered. And the other thing was, and this wasn't unique to the Soviet Union, but it was a common communist thing. And by the way, people today have no idea what communism was. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've watched Tucker Carlson's show, and he's got some guy, what's the guy's name? Something Kelly. I don't know what his name, like Jim Kelly, comes on, and Tucker will be talking about critical race theory, or he'll be talking about, I don't know, just, you know, or maybe censorship. And then Kelly just says, well, what you have to understand is these people are nothing but a bunch of communists. Well, they have no idea what communism meant. No idea. You had censorship in communist countries, but you had censorship in military dictatorships, which was in the 1980s. That was really the most common form of government in the world, was a military dictatorship all through, up until the 1980s, all through Africa, most of Latin America, parts of Europe. You know, Greece was a military dictatorship. You had military dictatorships all over the place. Pakistan, Indonesia, South Korea, all over the place. Taiwan, military dictatorship. You had military dictatorships all over, because Chiang Kai-shek was a generalissimo. So you had, and all these places, they had censorship, they had political repression, they had political prisoners, they had all this stuff. It wasn't unique to communism. It was not a defining feature of communism. It was a feature, but not a defining feature. And most countries around the world had this type of repression. What made a communist country a communist country if it wasn't censorship or, you know, critical race theory or whatever it is that these people talk about? What was it? Oh, and it wasn't simply having, like, social welfare programs. No. The defining feature of communism was two things: state ownership of the means of production and a centrally planned economy. So, state ownership of the means of production means that the state, the government, owns all the factories. It owns the factories, it owns the mines, it owns the railroads, it owns the communication systems. It owns the newspapers. It also owned the department stores. It owned even, like, ice cream shops. At least in the Soviet Union. So, If you wanted to get something, get a pair of Soviet blue jeans, you would stroll down to GUM, GUM, G-U-M, GUM. And that was GOS or something like that. The state is GOS, like the state. I don't know what U was for, and then the M was for probably market or something, magazine. Magazine, I think, is store. Anyway, so you'd have these state stores. Everything, the factories, the car production, everything was owned by the state. And then the plan, you had the economic plan. So the government consisted of not just, you know, your ministries of foreign affairs, your ministry of defense. You had a ministry of auto production. You had a ministry of coal mines. You had a ministry of steel. You had a ministry of I think you had a ministry of washing machines. You had all of these economic ministries, just tons of economic ministries. And they would plan. And they would plan, well, the central plan is to have production of 15 million washing machines or 20 million washing machines. So we are going to procure so many tons of steel from we're procuring it from the Ural Mountain steel mill, and then we are going to procure that, and then we are going to turn it into sheet metal at such and such place, and then the sheet metal is going to be sent to this factory, and we're going to be procuring motors from the Ministry of Motors, and then we're going to put those motors in, and everything was centralized. Very, very different from our economy today. It really couldn't be more different. Our economy is highly decentralized. I mean, well, okay. It is decentralized. You have like a zillion different companies, and you know, even though maybe small business is getting pushed out and you're having more big businesses, there's no plan. So if you want a I don't know, let's just say you want some little device. I know you guys aren't gamers, but let's just say you need a new hand console for your gaming device, whatever they're called, the hand things. So you go on Amazon, and Amazon doesn't have a central plan. You order it through, you could order it through Amazon, or you could go down to Walmart, or you could go to your GameStop, or wherever you go. And, you know, if you go to a physical location, they have some on site, and if you go to a online place, well, then they've got, you know, you'll have something sent out. And everything's kind of piecemeal. Nobody had the plan, nobody had to say that, okay, over the next 5 years, we're going to produce this many. This is what they were doing, five-year plans. So the thing is, they could never get it right. And they didn't have computers. Their computer industry just never got off the ground for a variety of reasons, and we don't have to get into that. But they didn't have computers, and so they're doing these plans. And do you think you can perfectly plan out exactly what people's needs are going to be 5 years in advance? No. So you wound up with shortages, but you also wound up with surpluses. And I can tell you that driving or riding across the Soviet Union in the on the Trans-Siberian Express and looking out the window, how many times did I go by some sort of stockyard, and it was just full of transformers. Tons and tons of transformers just rusting away. Or I-beams. I-beams just rusting away. And that's what it was like. Because there were some things that were built in excess. And of course, the other thing is that the plans, they only specified quantity. They didn't specify quality. And so quality tended to be low. If you go to a store, you'd see this. Things were low quality. They were low quality. And some things were in excess, some things were in shortage. Well, what happens when things are in shortage? Because remember, the prices are also determined by the plan.
Do you truly want to stay out of the system? Are you prepared to buy into the biggest scam since the Iraqi dinar? If not, then put your money where it belongs, in your possession, not in the hands of an international MLM cartel. At Kettle Moraine Limited, we will provide you with the finest Swiss-minted detachable gram sheets of pure 24-karat gold for hundreds of dollars less than the so-called privately issued credit cards with elusive gold backing. Gold backing? The only gold that I want is in my back pocket, not backed by promises of an operation even the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is suspect of, giving a rating of C-. To get the full story, visit SierraMadrePreciousMetals.com and go to the Valcombe Bullion Vault. Once you have read the whole story about the scam being perpetrated on an unsuspecting public and how you can avoid being a victim by purchasing these beautiful, barterable, tradable sheets of gold at tremendous savings and in the strictest of privacy, be prepared to take the steps to protect your wealth with the purchase of the real deal. Detachable 50-gram gold bars from Kettle Moraine Limited by calling 602-799-8214. Ask about our 1-ounce Valcombe detachable bars, which break into 1/10-ounce bars. And don't forget, for all of your precious metal needs, whether buying or having the need to sell, call Kettle Moraine Limited. Remember, no dinar, no celery, and no carrots. If you buy from someone else, tell them you want AU, not BS. Call Kettle Moraine LTD today at 602-799-8214. Kettle Moraine LTD, 602-799-8214.
Hi, Tom Bolton for EaseOff. I know so many of you are finding our EZ4 carcass drop and lift an essential tool for your meat processing operation, but today I want to spotlight four of our new products. First, our right height hog cradles with steel or aluminum frames. Our customers love this back-saving innovation that enhances sanitation and speeds production. Next, our beef cradles with stainless steel or aluminum frames eliminate rust and corrosion. We hope you'll compare our quality and prices for this essential part of your processing line. Our cradles are especially effective when used with our power skinner. And finally, our hook tumbler will keep your hooks clean and polished. EaseOff.com. We make pigs fly. Cows, too.
EaseOff, LLC. 417-932-6419.
Below, if you go to a store, you'd see this. Everything, things were low quality. They were low quality, and some things were in excess, some things were in shortage. Well, what happens when things are in shortage? Because remember, the prices are also determined by the plan. The prices were determined by the plan based on the Marxist theory of value. The Marxist theory of value is how much labor was required to produce this. It has nothing to do with supply and demand. Nothing to do with supply and demand. Nothing to do with perhaps the intrinsic value of the resources that went into it. No, just how much labor went into making it. And then they slap on a price. And so there was no elasticity in the price. If you had a shortage of something, well, you couldn't raise the price. So what would happen? You know, in if you got the United States or a market economy, the price goes up. And if the price goes up, then demand for it falls because people don't want to pay that much. Well, price couldn't go up. And so what would happen is people who wanted it, they couldn't pay extra for it. All they could do is go and wait in line. They'd go down early, not go to work, and wait in line. And people were always waiting in lines. And you saw this. You saw it on the streets. Liquor stores, they were waiting in lines, yeah. Butchers, yeah, they wanted their meat. They were waiting in lines. People were waiting in lines. And what were they not doing when they were waiting in lines? They weren't working. They weren't producing things. Therefore, you're getting more shortages. So, this is the economic system that Gorbachev inherited, and he inherited a repressive political system to hold down people complaining about the economic system. So, he could have just gone along. I don't know how long he would have lasted. He thought he could have just spent 20 years, 25 years. You know, he lived to be 91, but the average age of Russian politicians seemed to be a lot closer to 70. At any rate, I don't know how long he would have lasted, especially seeing as the Chinese in the 1990s, in the 80s, but it really started becoming obvious in the 1990s, they had found something. They had found a way to reform communism, reform the communist system, move away from at least the economic communist system, while the Communist Party of China, the CCP, managed to stay in power with a near political monopoly. Well, Gorbachev thought he had to reform, and so he embarked on reforms. He embarked on perestroika, which was primarily economic, but it was restructuring. There was also restructuring institutions, restructuring the political institutions, the institutions that were supposed to represent the people. So you had, he implemented a Congress of People's Deputies, which took the place of the, the Supreme Soviet, and he reformed institutions, but the main thing, and you know, he reformed the government. He reformed it so that the there would be an executive president, that the leader of the Soviet Union would be whoever is the executive president, not whoever is the general secretary of the Communist Party. And so he became, in 1990, the president, the executive president. This is what they were saying on Radio Moscow, the executive president of the Soviet Union. So he did these reforms. And were the reforms doomed from the start? A lot of people, we know that we have people, a lot of people in our movement, who tend to think that everything's planned, right? The future is planned. And so if something happened in the past, that was planned too, obviously. There was a plan for everything. But I don't see it. I don't see it that way. I'm not that conspiratorial. I think that when I go to a basketball game, I don't think the outcome was predetermined. Maybe that's a radical idea. I don't think it was predetermined. I think that the teams play occasionally there may be a fixed game somewhere, but in general, I think that they play, and one team wins, the other team loses. Sometimes there are upsets, and I think it's the same thing with politics, that there's a struggle, and I think Gorbachev went into this thinking that the Soviet Union needed to be reformed. His model, I believe, was the Scandinavian countries like Sweden, which at the time were considered social democratic or democratic socialist. They had robust welfare states. They actually had very large public sectors. The government did run some companies, but the economy wasn't planned. The economies were market economies, even though there was a certain amount of state ownership. I think in the 1970s, was Volvo state-owned? I don't know. I think Saab was state-owned. You did have a fair amount of state ownership of industry. You had that even in England. You had British Leyland, which made the Jaguar. That was state-owned. I think Rolls-Royce, was that state-owned for a while? So you had these things. And so Gorbachev's model was to move towards not exactly a U.S.-style capitalism, but a mixed economy along the lines of Sweden.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Oh, homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855, the number 2, keep it today.
Extendivite testimonials on Amazon are very informative. Here's just a few. Carrie: great product, and I will continue to use. I've been taking it for over a year now. I'm 60 and feel great. I would highly recommend this product to anyone over the age of 40. Amazon customer, 5 stars. I'm quite happy about it. Extendivite has relieved what appears to be an angina problem, pain in the chest after climbing stairs, and short on breath. I'm quite happy about it. Amazon customer, 5 stars. Great product. I use regularly, and I rarely get sick. To get your Extendivite today, go to Extendivite.com. That's Extendivite.com. Or call us at 1-877-928-8822.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
Tune in Saturday mornings, 8 to 10 Central, to the Alternative Media with your host, Farron. If you've not been listening, this is some of what you've been missing.
2,000 mules, like you like to say occasionally, Farron, in your face.
They might have a set of lactating mammaries available that could provide milk for their adopted children.
Listen, news media, all pulling off this gigantic fraud.
Rhino, neocon, cucks.
There's this wonderful thing that's called Vote With Your Feet. Move to California.
I am a conspiracy factualist, and everyone else is a reality theorist.
Hundreds, if not thousands, of ships came out of nowhere.
Give me liberty, or let's give you death.
Any excuse to go and kill yourself for this fraud of a government. This goes back 100 years.
When they come for your gold, give them a lead, and when they come for your guns, give them the bullets first. And God help us all.
And so Gorbachev's model was to move towards not exactly a U.S.-style capitalism, but a mixed economy along the lines of Sweden with a welfare state. And I think this is what he was attempting. Well, I know this is what he was attempting to do. And, of course, there was one other problem that he faced besides the economy, and that was the ethnic problem, the nationalities problem. And a lot of people don't really know how the Soviet Union was structured. Here's the thing. In the Soviet Union was more or less born out of World War I. So in World War I, which started in August, the Guns of August, 1914, and it was... It came to an end officially with the armistice of November 1918. Well, in 1917, you had the Russian Revolution. You had what I guess they called the March Revolution and then the October Revolution. The March Revolution overthrew the Tsar, but didn't kill the Tsar. And then you had this provisional government run by a Menshevik, but not like the Menshevik party leader. And, what was his name? His name slipped my mind. But at any rate, you had a provisional government, and then that was overthrown in October by Lenin's Bolshevik Revolution. Well, what did the Bolshevik Revolution establish in 1917? It did not establish the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. It actually established The Russian Soviet Federated Socialist Republic, the RSFSR, the Russian Soviet Federated Socialist Republic. That was what was established. And for 5 years, that was the entity that Lenin ruled. Lenin only briefly ruled the USSR. A lot of people don't know that. It only briefly, and mostly as a disabled figurehead, because he had a stroke shortly after the founding of the Soviet Union. No, he ruled the Russian Soviet Federated Socialist Republic, which had lost a lot of territory. They in the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. I always just stop at the Brest. But at that party, at that treaty, Lenin agreed to a great deal of territorial concessions. He gave up Finland, gave up Poland, gave up the three Baltic states of Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. Lost a lot of territory. And then, of course, then you had the Russian Civil War between the Reds and the Whites, and the Moscow. Lenin was not in control of the Far East. For a while, you had it wasn't internationally recognized, but you had a Far East Republic that was set up more or less from Lake Baikal to the Pacific Ocean under a Jew from Chicago. He was a Russian Jew, but he'd come from Chicago. And it was kind of a buffer state between Japan and Soviet Russia, what you could call Soviet Russia. What happened was in the beginning of 1922, that's when the Soviet Union was founded. And because you had for a brief period of time, you had an independent Ukraine. You had an independent Transcaucasia, which would include mainly Georgia, but also Azerbaijan and Armenia. And so the Union of Soviet Socialist Republic, well, the Far East Republic was incorporated into the RSFSR, the Russian Soviet Federated Socialist Republic. The Ukraine and Transcaucasia, and I guess Belarus too, were incorporated not into the RSFSR, but they came under this new state, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. So they became Soviet Socialist Republics on equal footing with Russia. And before long, you had the Central Asian territories were set up as Soviet Socialist Republics that were not part of Russia. So you had Kazakhstan, what was called the Kazakh Soviet Socialist Republic, the Uzbek Soviet Socialist Republic, the Turkmen Soviet Socialist Republic, the Kyrgyz Soviet Socialist Republic, the Tajik Soviet Socialist Republic in Central Asia. And then in the Transcaucasian Soviet Socialist Republic was eventually broken up into the Georgian Soviet Socialist Republic, the Armenian Soviet Socialist Republic, and the Azerbaijani Soviet Socialist Republic. Ukraine was the Ukraine Soviet Socialist Republic. You had Belarus was the Belarusian Soviet Socialist Republic. And then after World War II, when some territories were reconquered, you had the Estonian Soviet Socialist Republic, the Latvian Soviet Socialist Republic, and the Lithuanian Soviet Socialist Republic. And finally, territory that was gained from Romania, which was on the Axis side, the losing side of World War II, the Moldovan Soviet Socialist Republic. And so you wound up with these 15 republics, Russia, and then these 14 other ones. The Russian was not Russian Soviet Socialist Republic, it was Russian Soviet Federated Socialist Republic. And inside Russia, you did have autonomous Soviet Socialist Republics. So you had the Chechen Ingush Soviet Socialist Republic. You had the Tatar Soviet Socialist Republic. I'm sorry, the Tatar Autonomous Soviet Socialist Republic. You had these ASSRs, autonomous. They were a level down. I know, is this boring for you? Probably. But anyway, that's the way it was. This is what Gorbachev inherited. He inherited a union. He was leader of the union. He wasn't leader of Russia. He was leader of the Union, which included Ukraine and Belarus and the Baltic states and Caucasian states and Moldova and the Central Asian republics, all of these places. He was ahead of the Union. He was not ahead of Russia. And then Russia, inside Russia, you had most of the places are called oblasts, which means regions. Some of the oblasts were considered autonomous oblasts. They had a little bit more autonomy, you know, probably cultural, because none of these places really had much autonomy. And then you had a few autonomous republics, republics within Russia. Dagestan was a autonomous Soviet Socialist Republic. So he had that. This is what Gorbachev, he inherited a country that at the time had about 280 million people, maybe 155 million ethnic Russians, maybe 45 or 50 million Ukrainians, ethnic Ukrainians, and what, 6, 7 million ethnic Belarusians, and all those three are all very, very similar. And so the bulk, you know, over 200 million of this 280 million were Slavs, very similar to each other. But then you had, you know, what, 65, 70 million of other groups, Georgians, who are speak a very different language. It's not even an Indo-European language. Azerbaijanis, who are basically Turks, Armenians, these Central Asians who, some of them look more or less Turkic, some of them look more Mongolian. They speak a Turkic kind of language. You had the three Baltic republics and the Moldovans, who are basically Romanian. So you had all these different groups. And I've mentioned a couple of times that I had read in the early 80s, I read a book by a French, actually she was ethnic Georgian, but she was a French political scientist named Hélène Carrière-Doncos. And she wrote a book called The Decline of an Empire. I think that's what it was. And it was about the ethnic problems and the possibility of, in particular, these Muslim areas, which would be Central Asia, but also Azerbaijan. These Muslim areas, which had growing populations, aspiring to secede from the Soviet Union. That was her thesis. And I was fascinated by it. Now, that didn't happen. The Muslim areas actually were the ones who least wanted to secede from the Soviet Union. They were kind of orphaned. It was the European areas that were pushing for breaking up the Soviet Union. It was the white areas, you know, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania in particular, but also Ukraine, and also Georgia. Those areas that's where the big pushes for independence. That's where the big centrifugal force was coming from. So Gorbachev inherited that as well. And, you know, one could say, and I said on David's show today, when I remember in May 1989, I was a journalist and I was watching seeing the news wire articles about what was going on in Tiananmen Square. Tiananmen Square, what kicked that off? Well, I mean, there had been student protests in, March and April. Students were protesting bad conditions. Gorbachev came, in May? He came in May for a visit to Beijing. And because he came, the Chinese let in a lot of Western journalists who normally wouldn't be there. Well, the Western journalists saw these demonstrators and they focused on them. And then Gorbachev came, and the whole line, all the reporting was Gorbachev has got it right. Gorbachev is doing political reforms before economic reforms. That's the right way to do it. The Chinese are trying to do economic reforms while neglecting political reforms, and they're just getting a whole bunch of political dissatisfaction. And so Gorbachev has it right, the Chinese have it wrong. That was the reporting line. And then Gorbachev, he had his meeting. It was, there hadn't been a Soviet leader in Beijing, I think, since Khrushchev had visited Mao and got a very cold reception in the mid-1950s. So, you know, it had been about 35 years or so. I think that's how long it had been. So it was a very historic visit. Well, Gorbachev leaves, and then, you know, the events of Tiananmen Square with a crackdown that proceeds. That's that's a different history. Of course, now, you know, a few years later, when people were looking back, they're saying, "Well, actually, it was the Chinese that had it right. You needed to address the economics first." And of course, the Chinese, they've never really democratized. Gorbachev democratized. He changed the constitution so that the Soviet constitution had democratic elections. Now, like I said on David's show today, it wasn't strictly speaking one man, one vote. One third of the, like 750 members of this Congress of People's Deputies, one third, which would be 750, were elected, you know, by district. Another one third was elected by nationality. Another one third was elected by groups. You know, the Communist Party had its groups. I mean, it was able to elect so many. The Communist Youth League could elect so many. The Academy of Science could elect so many. These different unions could elect so many. And so, but it was elected. It was elected. And so that was the new Soviet parliament. And the president was to be elected as well. Well, the president was elected. But the first election, because this was March 1990, and Gorbachev was going full blast on reforms, and everybody knew he would win the election. If you had a national election in March 1990 or June 1990, Gorbachev would have won in a landslide. The outcome was not in doubt. But, you know, why waste 3 months when you got all these reforms you need to do? So the Congress of People's Deputies decided that the first presidential election would take place in the Congress of People's Deputies, which itself had been elected. And then subsequent elections would take place, you know, by voters across the country, which was a big mistake. It was a big mistake to do that because then Gorbachev lacked that mandate, that democratic mandate, that legitimacy later on, the next year when he was, well, in a political struggle with Boris Yeltsin. But at any rate, he had implemented elections, multi-party elections. He had ended the communists' monopoly on power. Now, like 88% of the Congress of People's Deputies were Communist Party members. But there were independents as well. And so he had done that. Was it the right thing to do or not? Well, you can never go back and say. But then you also had, and I know I'm going to be running out of time at some point, but you had the various independence movements in the three Baltic states and Ukraine and in Georgia. Those were where they were most pronounced. And Gorbachev, what he tried to do was to revise the country, to revise the Union Treaty. He was going to have a new Union Treaty. So the Soviet Union was a union of Soviet Socialist Republics. Well, he was changing it into a union of, instead of Soviet Socialist Republics, Soviet, by the way, just means committee, Soviet Sovereign Republics. And then eventually they just would say, okay, well, it'll be a union of sovereign republics. The republics would be recognized as sovereign, and the union government would have much less power. It would be mainly foreign affairs and military, but most things would be run at the republic level. And so he wrote this new treaty. I mean, well, I'm not saying he wrote the whole thing, but he was really engaged in it. And there was going to be a signing ceremony. I believe it was August 22nd, 1991. There was going to be this signing ceremony. And he was, or maybe it was the 20th, I don't know. It was something like that. And he was at his dacha, his country home, outside of Moscow, just kind of working out the last details. And then hardliners, including his vice president, sent the military to cut off the telephone lines and surround the place. And then the vice president went and said that Gorbachev had resigned due to health reasons, and Yanayev, the vice president, was the new president. Of course, he seemed kind of drunk and unsteady when he was saying this. And so you had this three, and that was on August 19th, and you had this three-day... Jeepers creepers. You had this... Oh, gosh, come on. Why does this happen? Why does this even happen? Stop it. Nobody cares. Why does that happen? I have my phone in my pocket, and it just starts spamming me with some stupid ad. So what wound up happening is the vice president and the defense minister and the military, they sent tanks into Red Square and in front of the what was called the Russian White House, which was the Republican government for Russia, which had in the meantime, and this, I know I'm running up at the end of the show, Boris Yeltsin.
Did you know that essential oils have had a multitude of natural health and skin uses in history, but have been somewhat forgotten by recent civilization? Susanna's Secret offers 100% pure and natural oils at prices you can actually afford. Do you have a house or office with a musty smell or mold? Studies have shown that essential oils like the one in our Thief and Robbers blend will kill or inhibit mold, viruses, bacteria, and fungus. Just diffuse with it, and you will see the long-lasting effects that even synthetic chemicals don't achieve. Purifica, another one of our products used to clean and freshen your house or give a natural scent when drying laundry. For that special lady, we offer a ginger argan oil in a beautiful cosmetic bottle or a pure argan oil, a natural acne-fighting product. Check us out at SusannaSecret.com. That's S-U-S-A-N-A-S Secret.com. S-U-S-A-N-A-S Secret.com.
Are you sick of censorship? TLB Talk is the cure. TLB stands for Truth, Liberty, and Balance. We are the newest and most unique social media platform to hit the internet. We were built out of necessity because big tech, big pharma, and big brother are out of control. The only thing bigger than them is when we the people are united. With that vision, TLB Talk was born. Our battlefield is in cyberspace. The battle we're in can be won by clicks of buttons and voting with your wallet. TLB Talk has no hidden agendas, no corporate funding, and we do not sell, trade, or give away any of your information. Our platform runs off of generous donations of members and merchandise profits. So please, check out our site. It's the best around. And be sure to stop by our store. It's loaded with items that'll have you feeling a sense of member pride and victory. Come unite with us today at tlbtalk.com and join the social media revolution.
Have you been looking for a trusted long-term storable food company? We have a solution for you. Simply Clean Foods is dedicated to providing the best quality food you can buy next to fresh from a farmer's market. Our line of resealable fruits, vegetables, and meats are suitable for everyday use, and you won't have to worry about throwing away valuable groceries ever again. Our food is completely GMO-free, and our stringent quality controls, plus testing for heavy metals, makes us unique in the storable foods market. Simply Clean Foods' primary focus is to bring clean food to people all around the world and change the way we look at freeze-dried food in our daily cooking. When you purchase from Simply Clean Foods, not only will you be receiving high-quality food, but you will also be supporting veterans in need across the country and those who are affected by natural disasters.
Go to republicbroadcasting.org and click on Long-Term Food Storage in the rotating sponsors banners to support RBN.
Simply Clean Foods. Do it today.
For Russia, which had in the meantime, and this, I know I'm running up at the end of the show, Boris Yeltsin, who was gaining popularity from, like, you know, 1989, 1990, 1991, he had taken over the Russian government, which was, you know, the Russian Soviet Federated Socialist Republic, that had about 75% of the Soviet territory, about 55% of the Soviet population, and it was a major power base. So, when the tanks were sent in front of his Republican government's capital, he went out and stood on top of the tank and gave a speech. He was the hero. The coup failed. Gorbachev came back, but he was a laughing stock. And then you had things were in a lot of flux for the next few months. It looked like Gorbachev was going to be relegated to just a figurehead, and all the power, like most of the power, was going to go to the republics. And then Yeltsin and Leonid Kravchuk, who was the the leader of the Ukrainian Republic, and then the leader of the Belarusian Republic, met and unconstitutionally declared an end to the Soviet Union and said, you know, it no longer exists. Gorbachev saw the writing on the wall, wanted things to be constitutional. He asked the Soviet, the Congress of People's Deputies, to vote the Soviet Union out of existence constitutionally, and then he resigned. Because he wanted to avoid a civil war. Okay, we're at the end of the show. I'll probably talk about this more on other shows, but I think Gorbachev was extremely well-meaning. I think he was responsible more than anyone else, although Ronald Reagan gets a lot of credit, for ending the Cold War and the destruction of humanity that could have happened at any time as a result of that. Unfortunately, Gorbachev made mistakes. He appointed people who betrayed him. He negotiated with Americans who betrayed him. And I think in a lot of ways he's kind of a tragic figure like Trump. But I see him as being well-meaning, having had a positive legacy, but then once the Soviet Union was terminated, you had a Jewish takeover of Yeltsin's Russian Republic, which was a massive disaster. And by a fluke or the grace of God, Vladimir Putin wound up taking it over. We're out of time, but I want to thank you all for joining me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio. And now, Moscow Nights, which was Gorbachev's favorite song.
Time to double down. I'm Peter Serafine, and yesterday's Liberty Minute ruffled some feathers, so I'm going all in today. If I take out a loan and make a bad investment, I still have to pay back the loan. Real estate, business, stocks, crypto, the investment doesn't matter. So why should student loans be an exception? College is an investment. You choose to go to college. You select your course of study. You pick the school. You decided to take out the loan. You are responsible. Oh, but the school lied. Or my advisor was horrible. Yeah, that's unfortunate. I'm sorry. But it's still your debt. And your debt is your responsibility and only your responsibility. I am tired of my hard-earned tax dollars going to bail out the bad decisions of banks, businesses, or individuals. Find more news and commentary at liberty-lighthouse.com. Until tomorrow, see this Pashem Parabellum.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.